This is part four of a series by Dr. Brad Littlejohn on how Christians can wisely approach politics. In this final lecture, Brad discusses how to think about citizenship.
So, how to think about citizenship. So thus far, most of what we have surveyed in our theology of politics would be applicable to any society in any time and place. Now, in fact, some of you may have been chafing in your seats, feeling like a lot of what we've said applies to an earlier era of society, one of rulers and ruled, not to a self-governing democratic republic like ours, in which we are citizens, not subjects, and in which we are also invited into the work of governing. Indeed, some would say that passages like Romans 13, which we looked at earlier, and even passages like 1 Peter 2, have very little to teach us today, because the governing authorities to which we are supposed to be subject are, well, us. We are our own governing authorities. This is a self-governing republic. Or, we might say, the highest governing authority for us is the Constitution and laws made in accord with it. So if any individual governing authorities try to exercise power beyond the rule of law, it's our job to restrain them. You know, I've already discussed that's in some sense the kind of operative theory at the time of the American Revolution, that they're not disobeying Romans 13. They're saying, look, there are multiple governing authorities here, and we're holding these accountable for overreaching. Right? Now, there's some truth in this, right? I think we do need to say, like, Paul is writing to a context where there's not that many alternatives besides, you know, submit and obey and make a good impression on your Gentile neighbors, or rebel and get crucified, right? So we do have more options available to us now in terms of how to engage with our governing authorities. So I wanted in this last session to reflect on what it means not merely to be Christians under government, but what it means to be Christian citizens called to actively participate in the work of government. However, before I do that, I do want to caution against overemphasizing the discontinuity. I think we can often say the world of the New Testament, so different from our own political context, doesn't really have that much to teach us, right? So there's four reasons I think we need to say caution against overemphasizing that difference. So one is, the New Testament is not a stranger to the concept of citizenship, right? The whole passage from Acts that hopefully you read, Paul is drawing on his Roman citizenship, and there's other places in Acts where he does this, but especially in these passages, where he says, hey, look, I'm a Roman citizen, that means I've got certain rights, you know, and the captain of the soldiers is like about to have him scourged, and he's like, whoa, sorry, I didn't realize you're a Roman citizen, never mind, you know, my apologies, right? So Paul has legal rights that he can appeal to hold the authorities accountable. And he uses those. He uses those to guard against the Jews who want to have him dragged off and killed. He makes sure he has a right to a fair trial, and then he ultimately appeals to Caesar. This is I'm bringing this to the Supreme Court, right? So there's a mechanism within Roman law that a Roman citizen can, in last resort, appeal to Caesar to see justice done. And Festus is like, okay, to Caesar you've appealed, to Caesar you will go, right? So you get a portrait in that passage of, like, the Roman, for all the corruptions of the Roman Empire, it is a constitutional government that has certain norms and procedures that ensure that a relative justice is done. Now, the passage also shows, like, there's this governor, Felix, who he says, you know, it keeps Paul in prison for 2 years because he's hoping that one of Paul's friends will send him a bribe to let him out of prison, right? So the passage shows, like, there are good Roman governors and bad Roman governors. There's Felix, who's just hoping to get a bribe. He's corrupt. There's Festus, who's actually concerned about justice. So it's an imperfect system. We get to see both sides of it. But it's better than, the Jewish mobs that just want to drag Paul away. So let's see here. So the concept of Roman citizenship at this time doesn't mean as much as it did a few centuries earlier. It's kind of been watered down as the Rome has expanded from a city to an empire. but it did still mean quite a bit, as we see in these passages. And yet, it doesn't prevent Paul from writing Romans 13. So the fact that he has rights of citizenship that he can appeal to doesn't prevent him from saying, submit, right? He doesn't say in Romans 13, you know, use all of your rights as a citizen to get as much as you can out of the governing authorities. Right? So we're hardly the first polity in history to have things like the rule of law, elections, representation, etc. In fact, polities such as this have flourished throughout Christian history. And yet this hasn't prevented Christians in every era from recognizing that there is nonetheless a basic power asymmetry when it comes to politics and government. There are those to whom we must entrust most of the decision-making power, and then there's all the rest of us. And so second, American government, as democratic as it is still not actually a democracy in the classical sense, right? The people do not rule directly. Rather, we have a role in electing those who will govern. Now, at its best moments, American republicanism has been about more than just voting, right? There's other ways in which we participate. There's jury duty, things like neighborhood watch, volunteer firefighting, community leadership, phoning your congressman, right? It's not that we just vote for a representative and then we just check out. We do participate in various ways in the governing of the community. But still, for all the founders' emphasis on participatory citizenship, they still understood this fundamental asymmetry between those who had been chosen to make the laws and those who were subject to those laws. So we cannot allow the idea of democratic citizenship to mean that every citizen is a lawmaker, which also means that we can't allow ourselves to think of every citizen as a law vetoer, right? We can't say, well, yeah, you know, I obey the law as long as I think it's a good law, right? And then if not, I veto it, right? Within the American system, it's the president's job to veto bad laws or the Supreme Court's job to strike them down if they're unconstitutional. It's not your job or my job. So that's where we make those distinctions. We say a law can be so unjust, it can require me to participate in injustice such that I am required to disobey it. But otherwise, just because I think it's a bad law, that might mean I hope the president vetoes it, might mean I hope the next Congress repeals it, but until such time, I still submit to it. To claim otherwise would make nonsense of the very notion of law. Three, if the American Republic at its healthiest has still enshrined a basic asymmetry of power and authority, it should be clear the American Republic is certainly not at its healthiest now. Power has been increasingly consolidated at the federal level rather than the states. And within the federal level, power has flowed away from the most accountable and representative institution, Congress, toward unaccountable, faceless bureaucracies, as well as the Supreme Court. So because of this, more and more citizens feel completely alienated from their government. We don't experience ourselves as active participants in the political process, but rather as subjects of a bloated empire. So in this sense, I think the current state of the American Republic is actually in many ways not that different from what Rome had become in the first century. And this is also true in another sense, for Christians specifically, right? There was a time when America was a Christian nation in many meaningful senses. Clearly, it is not any longer. So I was going to bring in this. Who here is familiar with Aaron Wren's notion of negative world? Okay, well, just one, but two, couple there, right? So this is a book that was recently published based on an article he did for First Things, I think, where he says that basically you can look over the last 50 years at this shift in the way Christians have related to the context around them. So it used to be we were living in a positive world where to be a Christian was a good thing. Like, you know, your neighbor might not himself be a Christian, but he was like, that's great that you're a Christian. You know, sort of everybody wanted to think of themselves as Christians, even if they weren't particularly devout. And Christianity was seen as a force for good in the world. Christian morality was seen as the kind of morality that we embodied as a nation. So that would have been true, again, regardless of how many people were actually Christians in a like saving sense. Society was pro-Christian in most places 50, 60 years ago. Then the shift happens, and it's, of course, it's very different in different places. Like, you know, like Greenville, South Carolina is not the same as New York City or something in this respect, right? But broadly across American society, there was a shift in the later decades of the 20th century to what Wren calls neutral world, where being a Christian wasn't seen as a particularly good thing, but it wasn't a bad thing. It was just, it was another lifestyle choice. Like, you're into yoga, I'm into Christianity, you know, that's fine, right? So no one judged you for being a Christian, but society didn't sort of go out of its way to privilege Christian norms. In the last 10 or 20 years, and again, especially in like major cities, that has shifted again to what he calls negative world, where being a Christian and actually living out your Christian convictions is seen as a largely negative thing. It's hostile to the goods that we want to pursue as a society. You're seen as a bigot, right? So Christian values are in tension with the values of the surrounding society. Now, I do think it's important to say, again, this is not a new problem. Christians have lived in negative world contexts often, and the New Testament is clearly written in a negative world context. So if Peter can say, in his negative world context, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable so that they will glorify God in the day of visitation, then that still applies to us in our negative world context. But we do have to anticipate that often what we consider, what the Gentiles consider honorable is not going to be the same as what we consider honorable. So within our new negative world context, the biblical language of Christians as strangers and exiles is ringing more and more true. Now, that doesn't mean that we should simply sort of roll over and play dead and accept our marginalized status and say, you know, this is great. You know, we can, there are some, I think, been some Christian teachers who've said, you know what, it's really good that the church is now disempowered and disliked and that society is hostile to us, because that means that we can be, you know, more serious about our Christianity. We're not, like, the persecution purifies the church. And it's true. Like, persecution is a purifying fire, you know, like it sorts out the wheat from the chaff. It sorts out those who are really committed versus those who are just along for the ride. But that doesn't mean, like, that is a good byproduct of persecution, but that doesn't mean that persecution is good. The church doesn't, we don't say, yes, please persecute us so that we will become more holy. And the early Christians, the period in which the church was going through martyrdom, they were actually aware of this temptation. Some of the church fathers would say, there are people who were tempted to basically turn themselves into the Roman authorities and say, hey, I'm a Christian, throw me to the lions, because they thought it was such a, basically, they wanted to get honor in the eyes of the Christian community by being such wonderful martyrs, right? Like, this was a sort of ticket to spiritual glory, was to be martyred. So that's actually a form of pride, right? If God brings you to martyrdom, embrace that cross, but don't seek out martyrdom. So the church father said, look, it's perfectly fine to try not to get arrested by the authorities. If you do get arrested, then courageously face martyrdom. So I think we as Christians now have to have the same posture, right? We should expect more hostility, expect more persecution, and yet we should hope and pray for laws and government that will not be hostile to us. Right? Okay, so all of that is to say, I think that our context in America now is actually, in many ways, similar to the New Testament context. I think we do have a lot to learn from Romans 13, 1 Peter 2. So I want to offer a few remarks on what it means to be Christian citizens, even in a context that does not afford many privileges of citizenship, a context in which we can expect to be disempowered and subject to largely godless rulers. We will call these the duties of passive citizenship. Then in the last part, I'll turn to consider what a more active citizenship looks like and how that shapes the vocation of Christian citizens in contemporary America. Now, when I say passive, I don't mean this in the sense that we do nothing, for the Christian is called to be active always, even in passivity. Rather, I'm referencing the etymology of the word passive. It comes from the Latin passus, which means suffering. So the first calling of a Christian citizen is to learn to suffer well. Now, again, that doesn't mean you actively seek out suffering, right? As we said, beware of having a martyr complex. If you can escape suffering, you're encouraged to do so. And we see this like Paul's advice regarding slavery. You know, the New Testament says, like, servants, obey your masters, like, learn to serve Christ even in that position of slavery. However, if you have an opportunity to gain your freedom, gain your freedom. It's not good to be a slave. It's not good to be persecuted, right? Moreover, political suffering is usually not just borne by individuals. Political suffering usually falls on entire communities. So even if you are supposed to embrace suffering, you're not supposed to, like, bring suffering on your neighbor, right? You don't say, you know what, it's really good that you should learn, you should be sanctified through suffering. So I'm gonna inflict suffering on you so you can be sanctified, right? And if you have an authority that's oppressing you and your whole community, then even if for your own sake you're willing to be, you want to learn to follow Christ through that suffering, you still have an obligation to try and help your neighbor escape that suffering. But there is a suffering that is intrinsic in political life. Part of it is just the suffering that comes from uncertainty. I think this is important to think about, particularly in our context. I think a lot of the conflict we face as a society is a result of this sense of uncertainty. We're living in an information age. We're so inundated with information that it's actually counterproductive. We don't know how to sort through it. We don't know what's true and what's false. We're looking for answers. We don't have answers. And there are people who offer to make sense of the political chaos. Like, here's the narrative. Here's the good guys. Here's the bad guys. And that's very, very attractive to us. But the reality is that's an idol. They're offering us a certainty that we can't have. And we have to learn to suffer with that uncertainty, to learn to patiently bear with not knowing exactly what's going on and not knowing exactly what the right answers are. So only a commitment to a patient suffering through the reality that we do not always have the answers we would like to have and aren't likely to get many of them can help us get off of this sort of hamster wheel of trying to seek more and more information to make sense of the world. Now, underlying this calling to suffer well is something more basic that we've talked about in the passages we looked at, a freedom from fear. So this, I think, is the most fundamental freedom of a Christian that is proclaimed throughout the pages of the New Testament. And it's the most powerful and transformative testimony that we can offer to a watching world. Hebrews 2:14-15 says, "He himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery." Right? So fear of death is the fundamental condition of bondage that the human race has suffered under since Adam, right? And that is Christ's resurrection and promise of our future resurrection is so transformative because it should liberate us from that fear of death that ultimately underlies all other fears. And 1 John says, "So we have come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in the world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love." So again, you think about this in like the passages like 1 Peter, the relation of the slave to the master. As a slave, stop fearing what the master can do to you and think, how can I love this master as Christ loved me? And in that experience of you will find that that love casts out fear. It totally transforms your relationship to that situation of suffering that you have. So the perfect love of Christ should, for the Christian, cast out the fear that dominates our political discourse and that the media that we consume tries to force into every corner of our consciousness. Consider just how much of contemporary politics is driven by fear. Candidates very rarely bother anymore to tell you what they stand for or what practical policies they hope to enact if elected. Instead, they focus all of their attention on trying to scare you about what the other candidate is going to do to you and to the country. Of course, this domination of fear is not something that we just encounter in politics proper, but in all the spheres of politics in the broader sense that we've looked at. Our social lives, beginning with kindergarten and continuing right through our careers, are dominated by the kind of jostling for position that is driven by the fear of being an outsider, the fear of being unpopular, unloved, or insignificant. Fear of change, a change that might destabilize the things that I hold dear or leave me marginalized, is another dynamic that drives our social lives. And the same dynamics appear over and over in church politics. To all this fear, the New Testament says no. We should not fear those who can kill the body but cannot touch the soul. And as for our souls, we rest secure by faith in Christ that they will be preserved to eternal life. And if God is for us, who can be against us? So the posture of New Testament Christians toward an extraordinarily hostile political environment was, quite simply, freedom. The rulers of this world lie under the judgment of Christ, and hence we can laugh at their claims. We can live like truly free people, the only truly free people, in a world full of people cringing in fear of the powerful or desperately trying to impress them. But note that this is a freedom in obedience, not a freedom from obedience. We do not laugh at earthly rulers to mock, despise, or dismiss them. Rather, we gently laugh at their pretensions and then avoid making a fuss over demands that may be unreasonable, but that from an eternal perspective cannot affect us one way or the other. So it is that Jesus, after declaring that the sons are free, says, go ahead and pay the tax anyway. Peter, calling us to live as people who are free, at the same time calls on us to be subject to every human institution for the Lord's sake. Now again, although I've treated all this under the heading of passive obedience, all of this manifests in activity. It's the activity of cheerful, eager love and service of our neighbors within whatever political context God has called us, however inhospitable. I genuinely believe that in the midst of our politics of fear, Christians can offer a truly transformative witness simply by practicing a non-anxious presence, or what I call a detached engagement. All around us, the temptation is to go in one of two directions. Either you go all in on politics, obsessing about it day and night, following the polls and the headlines, worrying about what the other side is doing, and trading conspiracy theories. Or you just cynically check out. Both parties are corrupt. Politics is a waste of time. So what does it look like to be both engaged and detached? To be present in, with, and for the polity around you, and yet, knowing that your citizenship is in heaven, to be unfazed by whatever happens. That, I think, is the challenge for Christians in our present moment, to model what this detached engagement looks like. So, how are we for time? Let's see here. Okay. So everything I've just said applies even in contexts where citizens are more like subjects, where they have very few legal rights and very little political agency. Now, this might be the future that we're heading for in America, and it may already feel like that in some places. But thankfully, we are not quite there yet. We still have innumerable rights that Christians in most countries for most of history have not enjoyed. And we have legitimate means for protecting and vindicating those rights. So there's two main rights that I want to highlight. The right to seek justice from the courts according to our laws, which is a lot of what you see Paul doing as a Roman citizen in Acts, and the right to vote for those who will make our laws. Now, before I discuss these important points, I want to pause and ponder what we mean by speaking of rights. This is language that we use all the time as Americans. But is it right for Christians to think in terms of rights? Fair question. The language of rights, after all, encourages us to think in terms of possessiveness. Me, mine, my rights. And this is clearly the way that rights language generally functions today. Everybody demands that their rights to say what they want, dress how they want, go where they want, and act how they want be respected. And if anybody dares interfere, they're ready to sue. Right? Now, this doesn't seem to be a very Christian way of thinking. And indeed, Paul rebukes the Corinthian Christians for just this sort of litigiousness. He says, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? So on this basis, a number of theologians through the centuries have wrestled with whether it could ever be legitimate for a Christian to appeal to the law for protection. Like, is it lawful to file, is it morally appropriate to file a lawsuit? Now, the lawyers in this room will be glad to know. I think the answer is yes. You're not out of a job yet, but so long as we have the right attitude. Now, but that attitude is not easy, and we should beware of self-deception. So for Christians, the right way to think about rights is as the plural of right. Okay, what do I mean by that? Right, the right way to think about rights is as the plural of right. So our current secular order thinks of rights quite truly as individual possessions, as fundamentally plural, residing in the transcendent value of the human will. Each of us, there are like seven, how many people are there on the planet now? 7, 8 billion, whatever. There are 8 billion bundles of rights on the planet, is how the modern secular rights theory thinks, right? But as Christians, we know that the only will that has transcendent value is God's will. God has established what is right in the singular. There is one right, a universal moral order binding on all of us. And we discussed this in the last session under the heading of natural law. Now, the natural law prescribes duties for each and every one of us. We have, as we saw, duties to God, duties to self, duties to neighbor, three categories of duties under natural law. Now, it is right for me to carry out these duties. And thus, I can say that I have a right to carry them out. If it is right for me to, if it is right for me to feed my children, we'll put it that way, right? If it's right for me to provide for my children, then we can say I have a right to provide for my children and to have the means necessary to provide for them. But notice that the right derives from the duty, not the other way around. So as a Christian, I can invoke my right of free speech if I am being prevented from carrying out my duty of speaking the truth about God and his world. I can't invoke this right just because I feel like talking and someone won't let me. Right? So, all right, so what does all this tell us about the right to seek justice from the courts? To engage in a lawsuit on this account is to notify the authorities that an objective wrong has been committed and to invite them to rectify it, right? So somebody breaks into your car and you file a lawsuit, right? You call the police. You are not doing that to protect your right as a property owner, probably speaking. You are doing that to notify the civil authorities that an objective wrong has been committed against the moral order. And it just happens, so happens to be you. But it, you know, could have been your neighbor's car. And you should, this is the test. Like, would you be willing to call the police over the injustice to your neighbor as you are for the injustice to you? Right? You should love your neighbor as yourself, which is to say you should love yourself as you would your neighbor. So it's the authority's God-given task, as we've seen in Romans 13, to rectify injustices. So you can think of filing a lawsuit, any lawsuit is just like calling one of those informational hotlines they set up to report on the whereabouts of a criminal. Right? The Christian is not zealous for his own rights, but he's acting as a concerned citizen, helping the public authorities do their job by bringing a wrong to their notice. Now, in a political order like ours, this doesn't just mean bringing the wrongs of private citizens to the notice of authorities. It can also mean holding the authorities themselves to account. I closed the last lesson by noting that the purpose of law is not simply to act as a restraint on citizens, but a restraint on rulers as well. When a ruler passes a law, those who govern pledge themselves to rule only according to those laws. And in a society with a written constitution like ours, the constitution itself functions as a law governing the very act of lawmaking. Laws that violate the constitution are not valid. Now, who gets to decide whether an authority is violating the law or the constitution? Well, in the first place, other authorities, right? The American constitutional system was designed with lots of checks and balances. That's different kinds of authorities operating at different levels, each tasked with keeping an eye on the others to make sure they don't trespass the bounds of their authority and oppress the people. Now, what I think fewer people know is this system, American system of checks and balances, is a direct heir of the Protestant reformers' theory of the lesser magistrate. Right? And this arose in the aftermath of the Reformation. The Reformers were very concerned about following Romans 13. And in fact, one of their protests against the papacy was that the Pope claimed the supreme right of determining when civil authorities should and shouldn't be obeyed. So he could dispense. He could tell an entire kingdom. He could say, I have decided that your ruler does not deserve to be obeyed, and so all of you guys should, you know, are licensed to disobey, or in fact, even extreme cases, ordered to disobey and rebel, right? So the Pope set himself up as somebody who could basically nullify Romans 13, or he was the only one who could decide when it didn't apply. So the Reformers put a lot of emphasis on, no, we need to respect and obey civil authorities. But what about when those civil authorities were acting on behalf of the Pope and persecuting Protestants? Right? So what do they do about that? If they're trying to suppress the Reformation, what are we supposed to do? Do we just accept, maybe we do just accept persecution. But it'd be nice if there were something else that we could do besides just being burned at the stake, right? So they start to explore these different accounts, and they realize, well, there's this idea of the lesser magistrate, right? Even in early modern Europe, it wasn't the case that we think of it as just like, you know, these absolute monarchs. But that wasn't the case. There were all these nobility who also had a lot of political authority, and the monarchs had to share authority with the nobility. And the Reformers said, look, those guys, you know, the Earl of Dorset or whatever, he too is one of the governing authorities of Romans 13. And it's his job to see that God's law is upheld. And so if the king is acting against God's law, then these other lesser magistrates have an obligation before God to hold him accountable. Right? So one of the most famous texts elaborating this theory, it was called the Vindicii Contra Tyrannos, right? A legal remedy against tyrants. And it's a very significant title because it's saying this is a legal remedy against tyrants. This is a way of resisting tyrants that it's not like outright revolution. You're not saying political authority is at an end, we're going to rise up and defend ourselves. You're saying no, we are still working within political authority, within a legal order, to restrain tyrants, right? Because there are many levels of authority within any political system. So that principle underlies our American order. In fact, anybody who holds any kind of public office in our system of government is a kind of lesser magistrate, right? Even down to like the county sheriff. The county sheriff can decide whether or not to enforce a law. If he says, look, this is a very unjust law I'm being asked to enforce, I'm not going to do it. He is exercising his responsibility as a lesser magistrate. Now, although we don't have this authority as private citizens, there's still a distinction between the lowest magistrate and a private citizen, we do have the right and indeed the responsibility to appeal to the courts if we believe that one of our authorities is operating outside of their legal authority. All right, so much for lawsuits. Let's talk about voting, right? So Paul had, to some extent, that right of appealing to one authority against another authority. What Paul, as a Roman citizen, never had was the right to vote. So that is something that we do still enjoy, even though it sometimes seems that, you know, our votes don't mean much, but at least they mean something, right? Now, I think we probably focus too much attention on voting. As modern Americans, I think there are usually a lot of ways, like every 4 years, and this is part of why I'm doing this course right now. It's an election year, and we always get worked up about our obligation as Christian citizens in a voting season. Really, I think our most important obligations as Christian citizens happen outside of this ritual of voting, right? There's ways in which we can have a bigger impact on our community than voting is likely to have. But still, it's a fundamental privilege of American citizenship, and we do have an election coming up, so let's talk about it. Now, I've said that rights presuppose duties. So that might suggest that if we have a right to vote, I think that we have a strict moral duty to vote. And this is an important question. Some people would say you have an obligation to vote. Now, I don't think this is quite right, right? Voting is a blessing and a privilege. It's an opportunity to use the gift of citizenship to register our views about what our nation needs. We shouldn't scorn this privilege, but we shouldn't construe it as a compulsion, right? Anybody who has a right to vote also has the right to abstain. We see this principle if you're on a board, right? If you're on a, I assume this works on your vestry. You can say, so the decision's being made and you really don't feel like you have an informed enough opinion, or for whatever reason you say, I'm going to abstain. And to abstain is itself a kind of vote. It's a sort of, you know, neither of the above, right? So I think if some Christians honestly feel too conflicted to vote, there's no sense guilt-tripping them into recklessly pulling the lever for one candidate or the other. Even abstaining is a vote that says, give me better candidates next time. That said, I don't think we should simply throw up our hands in resignation without an earnest effort to vote wisely. So what does it mean to vote? I think there's three main ways of thinking about it. Okay, so the first is pulling the lever. We use that expression, right? Now, that metaphor points to one common understanding. We think of voting as a form of utilitarian policy calculus, right? We're trying to pull this lever to achieve this kind of policy result. On this understanding, every vote is simply an attempt to maximize the chances of relatively better policy outcomes for the country. Advocates of this approach often use the language of choosing the lesser evil, right? And they particularly can't stand third-party voting, right? They would say if you vote for a third party, you're just throwing away your vote because you're obviously not going to have any policy outcome. Now, given that policy outcomes are very hard to predict, and it's very hard to know whether a candidate will actually enact the policies they promise, this utilitarian calculus is always something of a gamble, right? I was just telling my son about this. Like, you know, both candidates go around saying, if I'm elected, I'm going to do this. And it's like, well, no, if you're elected, you're going to hope that Congress will do that. But they might not, right? You actually don't have, nobody in the American system actually has as much power as the candidates pretend they have. So we don't really know what the policy outcomes are going to be of an election. And if you don't live in a swing state, it's kind of irrelevant, right? I mean, if you're voting third party is throwing away your vote, but voting Republican in California is also throwing away your vote, right? Or Democrat in South Dakota, right? Now, here in North Carolina, you guys are blessed or cursed to be in one of those states where it might actually make a difference, right? So still, we do need to be realistic about how indirect an effect our vote is likely to have on policy outcomes. Now, another metaphor we use is making your voice heard, right? In a democratic system, voting is one way that every citizen, however inarticulate, can register their views about the essential moral and political questions of the day. Now, again, we use this language, you need to make your voice heard, okay? Now, the reality is, you know, if there's 1,321,000 votes for a candidate versus 1,321,001 votes, you didn't exactly make your voice heard in a resounding way, right, by being that extra vote, right? And in any case, all we do is tabulate the numbers. Like, nobody knows why you voted that candidate. So making a vote is not a particularly effective way of making your vote heard. Now, from this standpoint, though, this is where voting for a third-party candidate might have make more sense, right? So the American Solidarity Party, for instance, founded on Christian democratic principles, received only 40,000 votes in 2020. Now, if that doubled to 80,000 in 2024, that would send a noteworthy message. And it would be a message to the two main parties that they need to work on their candidate selection process. Now, I'm not saying here that you should vote for a third party. I'm just explaining why I don't think it's necessarily throwing away your vote. It's using your vote to accomplish something else besides a policy outcome. Now, there's a third and final way of thinking about voting that I think we need to be attentive to. When we vote, we select a representative. Right? The representative is someone who symbolically stands in for us. Someone of whom we can say, that's my guy, he speaks for me. Now, it's here that the moral weight of voting comes into clearest focus. For when I select someone to stand in for me, it's hard to resist the sense that I have established some kind of moral connection with him, some kind of identification. Henceforward, his actions are in some sense my actions. And if his behavior, words, or policies are morally odious, I may find my conscience becoming slowly dulled as I seek to make excuses for them. However, and I think this is interesting, you can see people who like reluctantly vote for a candidate the first time around, then enthusiastically vote for that candidate the second time around. Why? Because in the meantime, they've come to sort of identify themselves with the candidate. And where they might have started by saying, well, yeah, I don't like this about him, don't like this about him. Once that identification is established, then they feel like they need to actually make excuses for the person. They can't actually be so honest about the person's faults. Now, from a biblical standpoint, though, this danger really applies whether or not I vote for someone, right? The leader, by virtue of his position, the king or the president, is my representative. Even if I didn't vote for him, he still acts on behalf of the nation, and his actions will shape the morality of the nation. So voting is weighed down with moral significance, but then so is life and society at every moment. We must learn to take the responsibility seriously, but bear the burden lightly, and also avoid burdening the consciences of others. All right, so much time for questions, but sorry. Let me bring this in for a landing by reflecting theologically on one other critical aspect of citizenship. So to speak of citizenship is to speak of citizenship in a particular nation, a nation of which most people are not citizens. To have nations at all is to mark a boundary between an inside and an outside, between those who belong and those who don't, or who at least those who may be treated as guests but not as residents. Now, I think this would have once been quite obvious, but now there's a lot of polarization and confusion around the issue of immigration, so I think we need to spell this out. If you're interested in this topic, I point you to an essay I recently published in First Things, A Theology of Immigration. But here's just a few thoughts from that essay. So in discussions about immigration, we often hear Christians insisting that we have a duty of hospitality toward migrants. Now, that's absolutely true. Just as every Christian family has a duty of hospitality to welcome guests. But having a hospitable home presupposes having a home, having walls and a door, and not a revolving door, but a door that can be and sometimes is locked. So a nation, like a family, exists not for itself alone, but for the sake of all. And yet, because of human finitude, to exist for the sake of others, a nation must first exist for itself. A nation has to define boundaries that mark the distinction between residents who enjoy a primary claim to its resources and neighbors who have only a secondary claim. So a family that never opened its home to others, less fortunate, would have failed to understand its calling as a family. And just so, a nation that offered no hospitality to outsiders would be rightly judged xenophobic. But in both cases, that hospitality must be carefully measured out. Right, a family would dissolve under the burden of housing too many guests, right? And so can a nation. So to uphold national borders is to witness to a truth that is extremely unpopular in our progressive technological age, which is to say, we remain finite beings in a finite world. Now, the boundaries, the finite just means limits or boundary, right? The boundaries of a nation, that's borders, maybe the arbitrary products of historical happenstance, or even the reminders of historical injustices, right? So the U.S. border with Mexico was not drawn in the desert sand by God. It was, in fact, a result of a shameless land grab by our insatiable young republic. But just because the border was established by injustice long ago, that doesn't mean the just thing to do now is to dissolve it, right? It might be that the piece of property that my house sits on was the product of some shady dealings centuries ago, but it's still my responsibility to care for it now as my property. In a world of fallen men, every border will reflect a checkered history. They were not drawn by angels. But as finite creatures, we must live in accord with them. Sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof, Christ warns those who wring their hands about the future, and the same warning applies to those who wring their hands about the past. So our Christian duty is to recognize that we must live within borders, imperfect as they are, and use those borders to help prioritize our responsibilities. We should seek to use the goods God has given to us for the benefits of all, but we do have to start somewhere. First, our own family and church community, then our fellow citizens, and only then for the needy of every society outside our own. Now, this point about borders is an appropriate place to close the study. For the Christian, politics at every point should be a reminder of our finitude, a reminder of our calling to service. Here we live out the fundamental paradox of being free creatures. Everything we are and do depends on God's prior action, and yet God calls us to be instruments of his action. Every heresy of political theology, we might say, comes from ignoring or overemphasizing one side of this paradox. On the one hand, we can err by idolatry. We can see political power as self-authorizing, world-shaping, or salvific. Or we can idolize ourselves as political actors. We can think that if we don't get into the fray, nothing good will ever happen. On the other hand, we can err by a kind of fatalism. We can justify our own complacency and inaction by mouthing pious platitudes that God is in charge. Somehow we must hold both of these together. God is in charge and has already acted decisively to establish his kingdom in Christ. But he has also invited us to take part in the great privilege of being emissaries of that kingdom in our own little corner of time and space. So, yes, we have just a little bit of time for questions. So I will again have you break into little groups and come up with a question as a group, and we'll get to at least a handful of those. So. Yeah, wow. Okay, so can we take up arms in civil war?
If you want us to turn the recording off.
Yeah, they'll turn it off. All right, so we talked about the case of the American Revolution, right, being a case, we start with a general point, right? The Christian tradition has said there is such thing as just war, just as there's just use of force in self-defense. I can intervene. I can use force to defend myself if someone's trying to kill me. I can use force to defend, my wife if someone's trying to kill her. And similarly, if we can do that at the individual level, we can also do that at a national level, right? Or another way of thinking of it is, a government has authority before to be an execute vengeance on the wrongdoer, to like carry out. A sentence against a crime, up to and including capital punishment. And war is essentially that same thing. It's a judicial act just carried out at a national level. The difference is there is no, in a country, the government stands above all citizens. There is no one world government. It's not a good idea to have a one world government that would try to stand above all governments and execute justice between them. So sometimes a nation has to go to war in defense of itself against another nation, and that can be justified under certain conditions, and a Christian can serve in that. Now, how does that work in terms of a kind of a civil war context? So the American Revolution is a case where, as we said, it's understood by most of the founders as they are taking up arms in defense of the lawful structure of government against a kind of usurping authority on the part of the king and parliament, right? So if it's just to take up arms to defend your land against a foreign invader, it would also be just to take up arms to defend your land against a ruler who may have started out lawfully elected but has become a tyrant. Now, in that context, here's the tricky thing, right? So it's never going to be entirely clear whether a war is a just war, right? Some wars look pretty transparently like a just war. Other wars, it's very ambiguous. And part of being a citizen and part of having God-ordained authorities is, just like we said, it's not up to me to decide, well, I think these taxes are being put to bad uses, so I'm not going to pay taxes. I can't ordinarily say, I don't know about this war, so I'm not going to serve. Now, I think that's one where if you really feel very strongly that a war is an unjust war, then you shouldn't serve. You should be a conscientious objector, and you should be willing to be thrown into prison as a conscientious objector. But if there's a plausible case to be made that it's a just war, then you defer to the judgment of those that God has authorized, and you say, okay, I'm going to fight in this war, and hopefully it is. And if it's not a just war, that's, they're responsible before God, not me. What do you do, though, if there is no governing authority that can decide that. If there's a disagreement between two governing authorities, between the Parliament, say, and the Continental Congress, those are two authorities both claiming to be lawful authorities, and you as a Christian need to decide which one you're going to fight for. And some Christians took the side of the Loyalists at the time of the Revolution, and some took the side of what we now call the Patriots. And I think both of them had plausible arguments. Both of them were seeking to follow their consciences before God. And so you could have two people justly taking up arms against each other in that situation, because they're both, there's not clarity about who the actual authority is. I think at the time of the American Civil War, that one's very clouded by the issue of slavery, is what one side was fighting for. But on just the, there were Southerners who weren't fighting to defend slavery, but were fighting because they felt like their state government had primary, they had primary allegiance to that. And so it was a kind of constitutional debate. So a situation can arise in which it's just no longer clear where authority resides, and in which multiple people claiming to exercise authority are going to war against each other, and the Christian will have to choose which side he thinks is in the right. And hope we can sort of hope and pray that that situation never arises in our own lifetime. But I would say it can arise, and in that situation, again, the Christian can fight justly as long as they are following their conscience and trying to see which authority has the just claim to being the truest authority. Right? So. Another question. Yes. Yeah. So you asked me this after the last talk. So I'll share what I think when people talk about character, there's really two different things going on. So people argue, should we vote for the candidate that's going to enact the best policies, or should we vote for the candidate who has the best character? Well, one thing I would say is, again, you don't really know what policies someone's going to enact. You know what policies they say they're going to enact. And their trustworthiness is dependent in large part on their character. So even if what you care about most is policy, character is a good guide toward what policies someone might in fact enact, right? So I think you take, you at least if someone says, hey, I'm here, you know, I mean, Trump was an interesting example of this because he did in fact, he made the promise, hey, I'm gonna give you pro-life justices. And I think a lot of people were like, yeah, but can we really trust you? You're kind of not exactly the most trustworthy person. And he did, in fact, give pro-life justices. So if you had judged based on character and said, yeah, we can't trust his policies, in that case, you would have been wrong. Even despite his shady character, he did deliver the good policies there. But the concern about character, there's another concern that I think, aside from the policy concern, which is where I was getting into saying, you know, the leader represents us, right? And so he sets the tone. Any elected leader, and the higher up the elected leader, all the more so, right? And especially if you're the head of state of a nation, you set the moral tone for the nation. You sort of you lead by example. You say, this is acceptable behavior, this is good, this is bad, right? And so, you know, I think like, Teddy Roosevelt is one of my favorite presidents, and he was, one of the great things about, like, Teddy Roosevelt was very concerned about, you know, we talk about falling birth rates now, but we think that wasn't a problem before, but there was actually significantly falling birth rates in the early 20th century, and Teddy Roosevelt was very concerned about this, but he didn't, like, try to enact pronatalist policies, but he, in the White House, like, modeled, he was a very publicly devoted father to his children, in the White House, right? So by that, he sets a sort of moral tone for the nation about what good fatherhood looks like. I don't think we have like statistics measuring the impact of that on the American family, but we can assume that it had a positive effect on the moral life of the nation. So character of a leader matters in as much as much, like more than we want to admit, the behavior of those in public office subconsciously affects our own sense of what is good and bad behavior. So we need to be mindful. Yeah. So the question is, you know, if character matters, basically the problem is we can say character matters, but that presupposes that we can actually form a roughly accurate idea of someone's character, which the reality is, like in a situation where, you know, you were, in a small community where you were electing, you know, a town of a couple thousand people, or was electing a mayor or something, then most people either know the person personally or they know them by reputation. Like, you actually have a lot to go on in judging character. And in that context, I would absolutely say you kind of, like, if you've got somebody who promises great policies, but is known to be a charlatan, and somebody else who you don't necessarily agree with their policies, but they're a man of integrity, then you sort of, you vote for character there. But in a nation of 330 million people, where everything that we get is mediated by many layers of increasingly dishonest media, how do we actually know what someone's character is, right? You know, like John F. Kennedy was, we now know, like a horrible womanizer throughout his time leading up to being in office and being in office. But no word of that was ever, he was from, you know, I talked about Theodore Roosevelt modeling being a good family man in the White House. To all appearances, John F. Kennedy was a great family man, you know, always posing with his kids and so on, you know. So the presentation was, oh, great family man, even if the reality wasn't, because in that case he had friendly media coverage. And if so, if a president has friendly media coverage, you'll get one picture of character, if unfriendly coverage, another picture. So I do think we absolutely need to say character matters, but we also need to be honest about the difficulty of forming clear judgments of character in the kind of context we're in right now. And, you know, I think just a note to close on would be to say, you know, like when you heard this conference advertised, you probably were thinking in terms of, you know, you're thinking in terms of the November elections, you're thinking in terms of national politics. And what I hope, though, is that we can learn to think a little bit more in terms of, like, you should be thinking more about, and I say this, I mean, I'm preaching to myself here. I never, whenever I get to the voting booth and it's like, oh, here's the town council, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who's my town council candidates are, but I should know. In the local elections where it is actually possible for you to form some reasonable judgment of someone's character, invest attention and effort into those. Those are contexts where your vote can actually make more of a difference. So, all right, let's close with a prayer. Please pray this with me. Almighty God, who has given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable industry, sound learning, and pure manners. Save us from violence, discord, and confusion, from pride and arrogance, and from every evil way. Defend our liberties and fashion into one united people the multitudes brought hither out of many kindreds and tongues. Endue with the spirit of wisdom those to whom in thy name we entrust the authority of government, that there may be justice and peace at home, and that through obedience to thy law we may show forth thy praise among the nations of the earth. In the time of prosperity, fill our hearts with thankfulness, and in the day of trouble, suffer not our trust in thee to fail, all which we ask through Jesus Christ our Lord.